We have the privilege of talking about an incredibly important subject this morning, a subject that comes out of 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter. I'd like you to turn there if you wouldn't mind. Just got back from the North American Christian Convention up in Kansas City this week, and Cam Huxford is a friend of, several of us in this room, but a friend of Julie's and mine. He preaches in Savannah, Georgia. Cam just got back from Rwanda fairly recently. And as he was telling the story, it's basically a pretty poignant one. Cam said, I was being shown around a prison over in Rwanda. You remember Rwanda back in the 90s had the terrible genocide, just the Hutu and the Tutsi and the massive death. He said, in this prison, I turned and asked rather quizzically, they're all in for murder? And Pius, the Christian gentleman who's showing him around, said, yeah. He said, I mean, multi-murders. I mean, everyone in here has been guilty of many murders. And Cam said, I couldn't hardly believe it. He said, I look at faces. They just look like normal. He said, there were some hardened guys, but they just look like normal guys. I mean, Pius said, well, they should look kind of normal. Some of them are priests, former priests. Some of them are former ministers. But when in it all broke loose, and here's the story. The Hutu and the Tutsi had not gotten along for a long time, and there had been inequality, no doubt about it, but you can't logically explain it. The human mind cannot wrap its hands around it. The Hutu, in particular, just simply snapped and broke with more violence than you can ever dream. Cam said it was more efficient than the Nazis ever thought about being, because in a matter of just a few days, really just a few days, they killed 800,000 of the Tutsi and some of the Hutu who wouldn't join them. And the way they killed them was just so efficient. Neighbors just took machetes and killed neighbors. You burned down houses with families in them. He'd burn down churches and schools with people in them. Pius was a Hutu, and which is the group doing the killing. Cam asked him, what did you do? And Pius said, I ran. When I wouldn't join them, they would torture you or kill you, and I ran. Cam said, if you look at the top of Pius's head is just slashed everywhere, scars just mangled the top of his head. He said, I ran. He said, and he told stories like being in the swamp for 3 days and just hearing the cries of the atrocities being done around. He said, I just ran and hid. But the story that Pius wanted to tell, he said, but I want to tell you about my pastor. He said, the whole church, both Hutu and Tutsi, ran to the church building when it all broke loose. And so the mob came to the church. And when they came to the church, the preacher was a Hutu. The preacher, he went out and he had his 3 or 4 or 5 year old little girl in his arms, and he had all his kids, several children with him, and his wife. And he stood in front of the angry mob and said, no, leave him alone. These are my flock. These are my people. Leave them alone. And the mob obviously made threats, and he said, no, you'll have to go through me to get to them. And they did. And said, outside the church building with machetes, they killed the little girl in his arms, killed all these other kids, killed him, killed his wife, and they burnt the church building down with everyone in it. Cam, as he's telling the story, has tears that are certainly welled up, because he can see it. He knows the people in the sense of finally wrapping his hands at least partially around it. But Pius just couldn't stop talking about the man who was shepherding his flock and protecting these people to the point of death. My pastor, that's what he did. If I can borrow from that, and I know that's a pretty vivid illustration, but if I can borrow from that, can I tell you that the day that Jesus Christ called you to follow him, he called you to be that kind of pastor. Please know, the word pastor, as I will use it today, the word shepherd, as I will use it today, is not a technical term, it's a Christian term. Please know that when you were called to be a follower of Jesus Christ, you were called to be a shepherd. God has raised up an army, but it's a strange army. It's not an army that carries any weapon of offense. It's an army that is shepherds and protectors. No reason to swear you in. The day you gave your life to Jesus Christ, you were deputized and sworn in that day. No reason to give you a badge. No reason to give you a title. No reason to give you an office. You're a disciple of Jesus Christ, and that by its very nature means you are the one who stands in front of and shepherds and protects those put into your charge by Christ. The radical call of Jesus is pretty significant. There were two kinds of people who followed Jesus. There were crowds that followed Jesus. Crowds followed Christ because, quite frankly, they were curious. Crowds followed Christ because there were blessings to be received there. And crowds followed Christ because even there, there was sort of a cultural thing to do. But crowds are a million miles away from disciples. No such, and they don't even hardly resemble each other. The crowd followed for those reasons. A disciple is someone who decides Jesus is who he claimed, and he himself deserves my life. And Christ receives my life. Here it is. I give it to you. And a disciple is someone who so loves the Lord, they obey. I can tell you that when that guy gets up from hugging the feet of Christ and saying, here's my life to obey you, what do you want me to do? Christ turns and says, dear child, you shepherd. You go shepherd my people. And at that point, the disciples are told and given the charge to give your life away. I'll tell you right now, even within our churches, there are still two groups of people. This morning, we have disciples of Jesus who gathered here. We also have crowd that gathered here. And there are worlds apart. You see, it's still kind of a cultural thing to do to come to church. It's still got a certain amount of at least some sense of blessing that comes out of it. It's still got some sense of just even curiosity factor and social factors. This morning, I don't know who's who, and it'd be silly on my part to speculate. But I can tell you the crowd is also gathered here this morning. And the crowd will come, and the crowd will go, and the crowd will call themselves Christians, and the crowd will do all kinds of things. But the crowd is massively wrong. Because nobody's life is being shepherded and protected on behalf of Christ by you, not in significant life-giving ways. On the other hand, there are disciples in this room who get it. Disciples who understand it. Disciples who say, that's what we do. We give our life up. There are people who give their entire life up to look after his people, to shepherd and protect. You may work at General Mills, but you're giving your life up looking after his people. You may raise hogs for a living, but you give your life up looking after people. You may teach school or raise children, but you give your life up looking after and shepherding the Lord's people. I used to think that the Christian life had a great deal of variation in it. I've decided it's not true. I think I was wrong. I don't think there's very much variety in the Christian life. I think it's a pretty singular path. And those that are on that path are people who are surrendering their life moment by moment, increment by increment, bit by bit, in every part of their life that other people are shepherded and looked after on the Lord's behalf. I surrender my life for the looking after of people. I believe it's a pretty singular endeavor. In fact, those who do so will reprioritize how they spend their time because they will spend it in such a way to shepherd and look after people. They will reprioritize how they spend their money because they will use it in the investment and looking after shepherding and protecting people. They will reprioritize their values and everything else. Again, this has nothing to do with titles or offices. It's just a private agreement with the one who shepherds you. Those who love Christ as disciples of his was shepherd. It's interesting that when Paul wrote about Timothy to the Philippians, he said, everyone else looks out for their own interests, but not my son Timothy. There's nobody else like Timothy because he looks after the interest of Jesus Christ. What's that? He looks after people. There's a lot of false honors given in the Christian life. Are plaques and awards, ovations. I myself am familiar slightly with praise you get. But I'll tell you, the only thing that's going to matter is at heaven's gates. Everything else was facade. when Christ applauds those who gave their life away as protectors and shepherds of the Lord's people. At Philippians 2 passage, where Paul says about Timothy, he does it right. It's the passage that says that's how you follow Christ. For Christ himself did not think equality with God as something to be grasped or held onto, but emptied himself and took the form of a servant. And you get into that whole context. I say all of that to bring us into this text. 1 Timothy chapter 5 is a passage on how you give your life away and where you give it away. And there's no way we can unpack this whole chapter. We need to, but there's just no way due to time. But we're going to hit at least a couple of things to some level this morning on here's where you give your life away. Would you read with me 1 Timothy chapter 5? I want to start with the first verse. Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers and older women as mothers and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. Give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. The widow is really in need and left all alone, puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. But the widow who lives for pleasure is dead even while she lives. Give the people these instructions too, so that no one may be open to blame. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. No widow may be put on the list of widows unless she's over 60, has been faithful to her husband, is well known for her good deeds, such as. I need to stop there and do a little bit of, this is not the easiest chapter to understand all the details in. Now, the principles are unmistakable. I don't care how you approach it. The principles are clear in this text. But some of the details, in all honesty, are a little, you got to work on. Here's what he said in the text about widows. He said, I want you to meet the need of widows. We'll talk about that at the very end of the message of his time. But he also then changes and says, now there's a group of widows you put on the list. Now, the fact that we don't live in Ephesus makes us have a question mark. What list did they have? I'll tell you what I think it is. He is not saying only help widows that are at least 60 years of age and only help widows who have been faithful to their husbands. And he's not saying only help widows who have. That's not what he's doing. In fact, here's what he's done. The first section on widows said, you help widows. The second section had to do with a list of women that are at least 60 years of age that you put on the church staff. They would be the group of women that College Heights would say, okay, you get full-time support from the church, and you become the group of women who, especially on behalf of the church, minister to the women, the original women's ministry. These are the women who are doing the baptism of women. These are the ones who are doing the hospital calling and teaching younger women how to, all kinds of things. So he's talking about two different things. When you read them, keep them separate. Help widows. And when you put them on the church staff, don't put younger gals on the church staff, because here's what's going to happen. And so he has a whole text there. I want to drop back down to verse 16. If any woman who's a believer has widows in her family, she should help them and not let the church be burdened with them, so that the church can help those widows who are really in need. There are two places this text that you give your life away. There are two groups that you stand in front as protectors and shepherds. These are in the sight of God two vital areas described in this text. One is verse 4, verse 8, and verse 16. You care for your own family. Let me put this as clearly as possible. The converted man or woman must accept responsibility for the care of their grandparents and parents. The actual word here is household. The word household is broader than just, in fact, I'm not sure that the translation of immediate family even communicates well to those of us in this culture. The word household included your slaves, if they lived there. It included brothers and sisters. It included aunts and uncles. The household word is a broader word than just, this is my 2.2 kids and my Cocker Spaniel and our little house. It's a conversation about your household. And here's what he says. The converted man or woman will accept responsibility to care for them. In Mark chapter 7, Verses 16 through 13, Jesus speaks to a group of individuals, religious leaders of their day, and he says, "You honor me with your lips, but your heart's far from me. Your worship is vain. It's not wanted by God. It's worthless." They said, "What do you mean our worship is vain?" He said, "Here's what you do." He said, "You dishonor God by disobeying. God told you to honor your parents. God told you to look after your families. But what you've done is you've taken the money that should have been used to honor your parents and look after them, and you've dedicated that money to God. You've said, 'Here it is, God.' And then you've turned back to the world and said, 'See how holy we are? We've given most everything we have to give to God.'" The principle in the text is you can't sanctify disobedience. You can't baptize disobedience. And in this text, Jesus says what you should have been doing is taking care of the responsibility I gave you over your family. That's what you should have been doing. Let me tell you, there's still a great deal of that. It's entirely possible for a person to spend their money on mission trips and say, "See, I'm really serving Jesus Christ." And the Lord say, "No, I'm sick of your mission trips. You've neglected your family in ways you should have been doing. What you've done is you've dedicated it to me, and you tell me that you're spiritual. All you've done is baptize your disobedience." No, you have a responsibility to your family. If God is offended by what's dedicated to Him, offended by what we say we dedicated to Him, what would He be offended about on these insanely expensive hobbies we have? What would He be offended about on the bigger house and the bigger house payment and the mutual funds and the cruise and the television set or a thousand other things that have drained away? So when I had the biblical responsibility to step forward and use my life up as a shepherd in my family's life, I wasn't able to shepherd because I used it everywhere else. Jesus, that day when He said, "You're responsible to take care of your family," I can see 1,000 hands go up. Man, there have been 1,000 hands that go up. Hands with all kinds of question marks. Somebody would have said, "Jesus, when you say take care of your family, wow, I mean, I understand that if I had a tender, gentle, wonderful family that was really, really a put-together kind of bunch, but you don't know my family. Jesus, what about a family that's mean? What about a mother or a father or a grandfather that's been hurtful? And what if we live at an estranged level from them? Do I really help that kind of family? Surely you don't mean those." You can almost hear the voice of Christ, can't you? A voice that says, "Not everywhere I ask you to stand will be easy." A voice that says, "Not everyone I ask you to love will be easy to love." Even the command to love your enemy, within it is the concept that oftentimes that very enemy will be someone whose genetics you share. Love your enemy, even if they're your family. But Jesus, wait a second, Jesus, every time I get back involved in my brother's life, my sister's life, my dad's life, every time I get involved, it feels like I'm slapped and beat, and it feels like I'm mocked. You don't know what that's like, do you? Somehow you can hear Christ say something about, "I think I do," and something about the other cheek. I know that whenever you deal with families, I know that boundaries have to be set with foolish people. Foolish people have no bottom to their foolishness. And I know if you don't set boundaries, I know the book of Proverbs and other passages, if you don't set boundaries, foolish people will take you in places that are very unhealthy for everybody. And so the Christian, even in families, will have to set boundaries. But somewhere you've got to face the issue. When you set the boundary, did you put love on the inside or did you put it on the outside? Sometimes the very jargon of boundaries is somehow to give myself an out. So I said, I called it a boundary when in fact Jesus would say, what you did is you set up guidelines and rules so you wouldn't have to love. Set your boundaries. But you're going to have to love. You were called to be a shepherd and a protector in your family. I also know you can't deal with unrepentant people the same way that you deal with repentant people. You can't treat them alike. I understand that. Dealing with repentant people makes basically a walk in the park. Dealing with unrepentant people, you'll deal with them separately. But even with unrepentant people, the actions of love cannot be absent. Let me remind you again, love is a verb. It's always a verb in Scripture. There's almost nothing in Scripture to tell you to have warm, deep, wonderful thoughts about someone. In fact, we're told in Scripture, you respond in some tangible way. That's what love is. In fact, I can tell you, I've got concern about what Christendom even sings for love songs to Jesus. Our songs that we even sing have had a little shift in the last 5 to 10 years where we sing things about our emotional response to Christ. And there's nothing wrong with having attitudes, but please understand that biblically speaking, Jesus said, if you love me, you'll obey me. The very concept of saying I love Christ is something I respond to, something I obey. It is a verb concept. And so the same set of love your families is always going to have something to do with the actions we do. I believe that James Dobson was just exactly right when he wrote the book, Love Must Be Tough. I believe there is a place where love sets boundaries, and I believe there's a place where love says, no, that would be harmful to you. And I think there's a place where you have to have some sense of discipline that occurs in people's lives. I have no doubt. But we can never take Dobson's concept of love must be tough in such a manner that the boundaries or anything else we have not loved in real and tangible ways. There's a man. This congregation has a brother who's been involved in drugs. A lot of years his brother's been involved in drugs. Back in January, February, I lose track of time exactly, he came in to visit with me. He said, I don't know what to do. He said, my brother is at that intersection again involving drugs. He said, this is an intersection, by the way, of softness. It's a better intersection. But he has nowhere to live. His heart's a little softer again. But we've been by this intersection so many times, it's got ruts in it. I don't know what to do. Everybody else is telling me, do nothing. Everybody else is saying this is his problem. Everybody else says, we've tried enough in the past. He said, I honestly don't know what the right thing to do. And we talked to the implications of it. We prayed about it. I didn't know what he was going to do. And he walked out of the office. I saw him about 2 weeks ago. He said, it's been an incredible journey. He said, we brought my brother into my house. He said, I cannot tell you what peace I have. If I died today, I will tell you I am content that I did what was right. And my brother has found the Lord in ways he'd never had. My family's been blessed. I don't know what will happen to my brother. Drugs are still going to be a struggle. I don't know how it's going to turn out. But if nothing else, what we did was right. And I am so glad I brought him in. I don't know how stories turn out, but I know that's a biblical response. Jeff Gloshen was sitting here last hour, and Jeff came up and found me. Jeff lost a sister to drugs. She's been dead about 2 years now. But I remember, and he said I could use his name. He said, you're welcome to tell the story. And Jeff and Paula wrestled through, what do we do with the sister? Because when we give her financial help to try to get her set up, it's like she will then blow it at the end, and the money we helped get her an apartment, and when we bring her into our house, And they labored with that, and they labored through, do we turn her loose and say, no longer our responsibility? Jeff and Paula made the painful decision to say, no, we'll have to set boundaries. There's things we can't do, but we're not turning her loose. She is still our charge. She left again after one of those episodes, had an overdose and died. Jeff said, I sat here today, and he had tears when I was preaching. I watched the tears run down his cheeks over here. He said, with her death, I know she ran away from us, but we never ran away from her. Can I tell you that's a biblical place to be? We may not save all of them, but we're not turning loose. Oh, we'll have boundaries and we'll say no and they'll be mad at us and there'll be all kinds of things that occur. But a man who won't take care of his own family is worse than an unbeliever. That's about finances and a lot of things. You recognize, don't you, that love is always voluntary pain on somebody else's behalf. That's the very nature of love. Love, by its very nature, is voluntary pain on the behalf of someone else. And so a little old young bride and groom who stand here and say, I'll love you forever, and they're playing romantic music in the background. And I'm glad there's romance. It is the fruit of real love. But you want to know what the roots of real love are? Voluntary pain on somebody else's behalf. It's the very nature of it. No one ever brought a child into the world that you did not go through pain in the very process of love. And the rest of your life, raising a child has painful chapters, but you voluntarily do it for the sake of doing what's right in their life. Love is always voluntary pain on somebody's behalf. It's always an investment in. Mike Gass was telling me yesterday on the phone, or Friday whenever I was speaking to him, Mike Gass has had a long-term illness involving a liver issue that I think probably genetic on him. I don't know exactly. But there's been a doctor in Barnes Hospital that has been wonderful for Mike Gass. Mike has lived a long, long time with this disease, and she's been wonderful. He told me, he said, I'm losing my doctor as a full-time doctor. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, no, don't be. He said, she's still going to manage my case at some level, but she's stepping out. I said, she's not retirement age. She said, oh, no. She's doing it right. Said she has a mother who's reached dementia point where she can't live by herself. And she said she had to balance, am I going to be a doctor at Barnes or am I going to take care of my mom? And she said it was an easy choice. And she's stepping out of the doctoring business because I'm having mom move in and I want to look after my mom with dementia. And Mike said, that's the kind of doctor that I want to have in my life. But I also know that's the kind of human being I want to. There's a responsibility, gang. Christian life is about accepting charge as shepherds and protectors. It doesn't mean you'll always flourish in the eyes of the world, but you will flourish in the eyes of Christ. There's so much we could say on this. Can I tell you, for the most part, what we have to give is pretty simple. It's in this text. It's kind of woven in this text. It's a subtle weaving in, but it's in this text. But it's throughout all Scripture. I can tell you what. You want to know what you need to give your father and your grandfather and your brother? You want to know what you need to give that son? It's pretty unmistakable. From the time that God made a little boy and brought him into the world, the craving of a little boy's heart, he doesn't get over it when he's 53, 63, 93, or 103. Does anybody respect me? Is anybody proud of me? There are tons of estranged people in this room, fathers and sons and brothers. And there's things you can't respect in somebody's life, but I'm going to tell you the most basic thing that you give is I will choose to give a man respect and honor for what I can. I spoke in Eugene, Missouri several years ago. Prison guard was been at the men's prison for years and years. He was just retiring. I said something about what's it like being a prison guard for all those years. And he says, honestly, there's days I love my job. Days I loved it. He said, there's days you hate it too, but he said, there's days I loved it. We talked about what's the secret to being a prison guard in men's prison. And here was his answer. Very straightforward, very serious. Everybody, every man craves and needs some respect. You give men respect and honor because of what they are, not necessarily what they've done. And sometimes you give them respect and honor for things they haven't even lived up to yet. I will tell you, the girl in this room who's estranged from her father, who writes and says, Dad, I'm so sorry for the broken relationship. I'm so sorry the way it is, but Dad, I want you to know I do have a respect for you for these kinds of things. I guarantee you that's part of what you do. It's part of what you do. There was a guy who came in a month ago. He wondered if I'd read his letter. He's estranged from a sibling. And the letter was basically kind of what I started off. I'm so sorry for the problems between us. I'm so sorry for the brokenness. And I hope and long and pray for the day that we'll be able to. But until that day occurs, please know that I do care. I don't know what to do either, but I do care. And I understand that you're not employed right now due to things out of your control. And there was a cashier's check of a pretty significant size sent. I think that's what Christians do. You love your enemy. And you love your family. And often those two intersect. We're not told as shepherds that we get to choose the ones we throw away. Women, I don't know how many women in this room or sons in this room are estranged from mothers or grandmothers. Every little girl that entered this world wants to know whether she's loved. Every little girl that ever entered this room wants to know anybody have time for her. Does anybody believe she has any value? And there are people you have to say no to because of all kinds of destructive habits in their life, and you cannot do everything they'd like you to do, but there's never a time that tenderness and gentleness and worth and value ought not be communicated into the life of a woman. We are called to be people who are involved in the lives of our family as shepherds on the Lord's behalf. You know what we do most weeks around here? Most weeks we are looking for a place to put someone, a man who doesn't have housing, a woman who doesn't have housing, a woman who's got a child or two, there's nowhere to put them. And we're always scrounging around trying to find something. When we start tracing it back, we'll often find they have family in this congregation, or they have family in the congregation down the road, or the family has a Christian family in the church there in Springfield or Tulsa. And sometimes we find out that it's real discipline, that the family has honestly sat down and the family is doing a painful discipline. It's the prodigal son who was embezzling from their account or stealing from their house, and so they have to do this. And so we partner with the family and we will contribute to the discipline as well. No, until brokenness comes, we cannot help. So that sometimes is the case. But you want to know what we find more often than not? It isn't a real discipline. What you find is, it's just my sister. And she's got her life, and I've got my life, and we sort of go separate ways, and we never get along, and my husband doesn't like her very well, and so suddenly the church is now taking care of your family. More often than not, we're just fed up. More often than not, we just went our own way, and they went theirs. This text has woven through it a biblical concept that my worship to God involves acceptance of responsibility. That I stand in front of the house, even a house may be on fire, but I stand in front of a house of a family, and my act of worship will be to love my family. While the praise team comes, I want to mention the other one real briefly. The other one in the text is you look after widows. Obviously, in this text, here's what he says, you treat widows like they were family. The word widow is actually built from the Greek word that means robber. Robbed. I mean, robber. Robbed. There's a difference between robber and robbed. I can tell the difference. It actually comes to the idea of robbed, which means that the word widow means a woman who has lost her husband, been robbed of a husband, but it's not exclusively that. It literally could be a woman whose husband deserted her. It's also a widow. It could also be a woman who's divorced, who wanted her marriage, but she was robbed of her marriage. It's not a word that there doesn't have to be a death certificate with this. Here's what he turns and says, I planted you on this earth as a disciple of mine to shepherd my people. Shepherd your own family, and you shepherd my widows, those robbed. We do that formally. The church would do things, and so part of what you give in your offerings will go, and we give thousands and thousands of dollars away to needy things, needy individuals. But we can't do formally what the church has to be doing, just grassroots and informally. You want to know how you three to take care of widows? Those who've been robbed, the young gal raising a couple of kids. Do you know how you really look after? The answer is just every single family here, every godly family here just wraps their arms around one or two. He just make them family. Same way you pay your utility bills, the same way you come here on Sunday mornings, the same way on every Tuesday evening, we just go by and check on Marie. We just go check on Marie. And Marie, she goes with us on holidays. Marie's just part of our family. Our kids wouldn't know what life was like not to include Marie. It's just what we do. That's when the church looks like the church. And if your money is not being spent in looking after those that are robbed, there's an indictment. How can you worship authentically? We were called to be shepherds, gang. The only way to live life is to create a handful of people. I don't know if it's your home group. I don't know if it's just a group of people you gather around, but you pour your life into them and you say, this is my worship. 1 Timothy chapter 5. This is the heart of God. Would you stand?